This is The Takeaway. I'm Nancy Solomon, a reporter in the WNYC newsroom, in for Tanzina Vega this week. Across the U.S., millions of people are getting vaccinated every day. The latest CDC data shows that 32.2% of Americans have received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, and around 19% are fully vaccinated. And that means there's a growing amount of real-world information on how effective these vaccines are. A CDC study published at the end of March showed that both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines lowered the risk of infection by 90% 2 weeks after the second dose. And the latest data put out by Pfizer indicates that their vaccine still provides protection against the South African variant of COVID-19. But alongside the positive vaccine news, there's also plenty to be concerned about. While nationwide coronavirus deaths are down over the last 2 weeks, overall, cases have been on the rise, according to the New York Times. And as cases go up, a growing number of states are continuing to move forward with increased capacities for restaurants, movie theaters, and sporting events. These reopenings are often happening against the recommendations of public health experts, many of whom say states should be holding off at least a little bit longer to help keep cases down. For more, I'm joined now by Apoorva Mundavilli, science reporter at the New York Times. Apoorva, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me again.
So we mentioned that there's CDC data now about the effectiveness of the vaccines in the general population. Tell us more about what the numbers show so far.
So far, the numbers tell us that the vaccines are excellent, really just so much better than we could have hoped on severe cases and deaths. And they seem to be very good also at preventing illness at all. What we don't know is whether they prevent transmission from somebody who is infected and who's been vaccinated to another person. And that's been a very key question that we still are hoping to get the answer to. And hopefully the answer will be that someone who's been vaccinated rarely gets ill and even more rarely transmits to somebody else. But we just don't know quite yet.
And how does this new data compare to what the clinical trials showed?
The new data is showing up basically what the trials showed us. The trials were obviously only in a few tens of thousands of people, and there was always some worry that when you translate to millions and millions of people getting vaccinated, maybe the vaccines would prove to be not quite as good. And that really hasn't been the case. They still seem to be spectacularly good. So we're very lucky there. As I said, the only remaining question is, you know, how often they might get infected, which also seems to be very low. And then if they do get infected, how often they might transmit to someone else.
And is there more detail in terms of, you know, because like this is the kind of thing that keeps me up at night worrying is like, do we know just how, you know, how effective it is? Like, is it less serious, the infection, when someone does get infected, if they've been vaccinated? You know, has anyone died? Are we seeing death still among a small number of vaccinated people yet?
We are absolutely not. And we're not even seeing severe cases so far. So I think the vaccines still seem to be what the trials measured, which is severe illness and death. They still seem to be, you know, close to 100% effective for that. So that has been really excellent news. And that's true across the board for all of the vaccines, whether that's Pfizer and Moderna or J&J and AstraZeneca.
That's good to hear. Good news. We need good news. We had a caller ask an interesting question, so let's play that for you.
I am vaccinated, but am holding off on joyous reunions for the time being. I simply haven't found any data or gotten any information that tells me about the efficacy of the vaccines for people with severe underlying health conditions. I have two pulmonary diseases, and I can't really take a chance until I know how safe the vaccine is for people with conditions like mine. So I keep waiting.
What can you say to Randy about underlying conditions?
Well, it depends what the underlying condition is. I mean, in Randy's case, I can see why she's concerned because she's had pulmonary illnesses and obviously COVID is a disease of the lungs. And so she is particularly concerned about that, it sounds like. And at this point, with the rates going up, I don't think that caution is unwarranted for somebody who is at high risk. It's also true for people who are immunocompromised. For example, people who have, you know, some kind of genetic immunocompromised situation, or people who are being treated for some kinds of blood cancers, they are at the highest risk, and we're not entirely sure that they produce a very strong immune response when they are vaccinated. So for certain people, it's not a bad idea to continue to be careful, at least until the numbers come way down.
So we are continuing to see, you know, COVID case numbers remain stubbornly high in some states, so, and even rising in some places. So what explains that recent upswing given the effectiveness of the vaccines?
This is something that experts had been predicting for weeks, that at the end of March, beginning of April, we would see the numbers come back up. And that's because there has been a variant of the virus called B.1.1.7. This is the same variant that was in the UK over the winter break. And that has been spreading in the United States. And this variant has been spreading exponentially, growing exponentially. And so researchers were predicting, just looking at the numbers, that around the end of March, we would start to see that come up. And even though the overall numbers have been coming down, at some point, B.1.1.7 numbers would grow enough that we would start to see those cases go up again.
And do we have a sense of whether the recent rise in cases is connected to states allowing life to come back more to normal, indoor dining, gyms, et cetera?
Absolutely. I think, as you mentioned in the intro, you know, a lot of states have opened up because the numbers were going down. But at the same time, these B.1.1.7 numbers were going up, and they didn't really pay attention to those, partly because it was hard to see that those numbers were going up because the overall infections were going down. And so a lot of states opened up way too soon. And now, you know, B.1.1.7 is finding fertile ground to spread because, you know, there are a lot of very few restrictions in a lot of places, but still a lot of vulnerable people who have not been vaccinated and who haven't had the disease before.
Earlier in the pandemic, nursing homes were particularly hard hit by outbreaks, and the death toll was quite extreme. So how are vaccinations changing that? I read early reports, you know, a month or so ago, that death rates in nursing homes were going down, at least in the state of New Jersey, I read that. So how's it going overall across the country with nursing homes?
Nursing homes are doing better overall. We are seeing fewer deaths from nursing homes because those are the highest risk people, and most of them have been vaccinated. And same for the people who work in those nursing homes. Overall, we've been vaccinating from highest risk conditions. So we should see lower hospitalizations and deaths in this wave, if it ends up being a full wave, than we have before. So that is a little bit better than, you know, any previous waves of the pandemic we've seen, where, you know, first the cases would go up and then hospitalizations would go up and then deaths would go up. And we may still see that those curves also go back up. You know, with the delay, hospitalizations look like they're already going up a little bit, but we can hope that it won't be anywhere near as bad as it was before because all of the highest risk people have been vaccinated.
And now that older people are, you know, in large part vaccinated, has that shifted the age demographics of who's getting infected and what, you know, the makeup of the new cases?
It has, and actually that also plays into why we're still seeing a rise in infections, because we know that even in previous rounds of this pandemic, the people who were getting the sickest and ending up in the hospital were older people and people who had underlying conditions, but the people who were spreading the virus the most were younger people, and most of those people have not yet been vaccinated. So we're going to continue to see infections until they are vaccinated and they're not spreading the virus quite so much.
And are we still seeing large racial disparities in terms of both cases and deaths?
We are. That's something that hasn't changed entirely. Hopefully it will change as, you know, greater numbers of people who are Black or Latinx end up getting vaccinated. And those communities are showing a lot less hesitation, a lot less mistrust of the vaccines. And the numbers of people in those communities who are either vaccinated or want to be has gone up quite a bit. So hopefully as those numbers really increase, we'll start to see that those communities are a little bit more protected than they were.
And you mentioned COVID-19 variants earlier, and has there been any evidence yet that there is a variant here that is resistant to the vaccine? I mean, I know that they're more contagious, but I think there is that expectation, right, that at some point we're going to face a mutation that's resistant to the vaccine. Has that happened yet?
It has not happened yet, and I will say, clarify that it's because of the word resistant. We don't have any variants that are resistant to vaccines. There are no variants that don't respond to the vaccines at all. What we do have are a few variants with a particular mutation that scientists call EEC, and that any variant with that mutation is a little bit less responsive to the vaccines. So it's not that they don't work at all. It's not that the vaccines don't work at all. It's just they are a little bit less effective against those variants. And it's possible that over time, especially if the numbers of people infected stay up, that we will see more and more variants emerge. And it's possible that some of those end up being even more invulnerable to the vaccines, and that, you know, we'll start to see a sort of degradation of how effective the vaccines are. But that has not happened yet. And the best way to prevent that is by vaccinating as many people as possible, as fast as possible.
So how safe are reunions, particularly with older vaccinated people at the moment?
People who are vaccinated can get together with people who are not and feel a little bit less insecure than before. But I think everybody should still continue to wear masks.
So it sounds like everything that we've discussed, that there is reason to be hopeful, right?
There absolutely is. And I think by summer, things will look a lot better. It's just that we have to get through these next few weeks first. And the more careful people are right now, the better those next few weeks will look.
And is there work already happening on a booster, say, to sort of look forward and say, okay, we're going to need booster shots, or we're going to need to face variants? Is there anything on the horizon that the pharmaceutical companies are working on that?
Absolutely. And, you know, as we've heard throughout, these mRNA vaccines that Pfizer and Moderna have made are relatively easy to alter. And so, you know, once it became clear that variants with that mutation EEC are not as responsive to vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna immediately started to test a vaccine for that variant specifically, the one from South Africa. And hopefully we'll have results from that soon.
Okay, thanks so much. Apoorva Mandavilli is a science reporter at the New York Times. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We asked if you've been able to reunite with friends or family, and here's what you told us.
Hi, this is Robin. I'm a teacher from Philadelphia. Last weekend, I was 2 weeks out from my Johnson & Johnson vaccine, so my daughter, who is also a teacher, and I took a trip up to Mount Kisco, New York, to visit my 97-year-old dad. My dad, who is a World War II vet, was vaccinated through the VA. We wanted to take my dad out to lunch, but he was hesitant at first, not out of fear of COVID, but because he hadn't left his apartment for so long. In the end, we convinced him, and we all had a wonderful time. We are so grateful to finally be able to see each other again.
Hi, this is John from Longmont, Colorado. I've been jabbed once, and on 9 April, I'm getting my second one. 2 weeks following that, which I hear is the time you need for maximum effectiveness, I'm going to get an antibody test, and pending that, I'm going to connect in person with a lot of friends and family. I'm just being really careful. I've got a lot of older relatives. They've all been vaccinated, but you know, just a lot of caution.
Hi, it's Cynthia Collins. We were able to go out for the first time in a year for my birthday last weekend since we had been vaccinated. I got to see my sister and my son and have a wonderful day out on the water thanks to us all being vaccinated. This year looked a lot different than last year for my birthday.
Hello, this is Jody from Charlotte, North Carolina. My husband and I have both been vaccinated and are planning to attend our granddaughter's second birthday party. We missed her first, so we're so excited to be able to be there for the special event. We've all been vaccinated. Her parents have too, and she's just starting to talk. So we're so excited to be able to attend.
Hi, this is Chris, and I'm calling from San Antonio, Texas. We made the 12-hour trip to Albuquerque to see our grandchildren, first hugs in a year. It was so worth it. Coming from a long line of huggers, going without for a whole year was tough.
Hi, Greg DiRaspino from Phoenix, Arizona. I've been vaccinated, so I am ready to see my family, hug my mom, and enjoy the company of friends, vaccinated and otherwise, in a social setting outside of the pods we have developed during the last year plus of this pandemic. I am a little nervous for those who are not vaccinated, but less so for myself. My mother, who is fully vaccinated and 84 on May 3rd, and looking forward to enjoying the company of friends and family whom I haven't seen in quite some time, at least in person.
Hi, my name is Matthew Bates. I'm in Beverly Hills, California. Over the course of 1 week in February, my father and my grandmother both died of COVID. And so I've returned back home to Lake Tahoe, where my mother lives, several times since that happened. And it's a calculated risk. We've always been a very close family, and now we're closer than ever. And it was important to me to be with my mother and my brother. My mom's fully vaccinated now, thankfully. My brother's fully vaccinated. My partner, who has been traveling with me, she's fully vaccinated. And I've got the first shot, but it is a calculated risk. We've been exceptionally careful throughout this process. But to me, it was more important during this time to be with my family. That kind of overrid any guidance that we were receiving from the CDC. And so all we can do is be careful, wipe everything down, wear gloves, double mask, and, you know, try to stay out of public as much as possible.
My 99-year-old dad lives 3/4 of a mile away in a living center that has carefully followed COVID health guidelines. Since he, my husband, and I have been doubly vaxxed, we were able to bring him to our house for dinner for the first time in a year. It is a wonderfully welcome change, but also feels like a guilty pleasure, not yet available to all. Hang in there, fellow Americans. It is worth the wait.
We always want to hear from you. If you've been vaccinated, are you planning on reuniting with friends or family? You can record and email a voice memo to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Or go to thetakeaway.org and click on Contact Us to record your answer straight into your computer or phone. And to see some of the photos that listeners sent us of their post-vaccine reunions, go online to thetakeaway.org. This week on the show, we've talked about disparities in global vaccine distribution, and the continent of Africa is one glaring example. According to NPR, countries there have administered less than 2% of global vaccine doses, despite making up 17% of the world's population. To date, the African continent has seen a relatively low number of reported cases, but scientists fear this may be due to an undercount, and that could lead to uncontrolled spread and mutations of the virus. In Kenya, cases rose significantly in March, and hospitals have been running out of oxygen. Today, we're going to hear from Beryl Akun, a doctor in Nairobi, Kenya, with the African Medical and Research Foundation. Dr. Akun, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
What are you seeing there in Kenya in terms of COVID cases?
Currently, we have rises in numbers of COVID cases. And just like you've said, the hospitals are full. We have run out of ICU spaces for our patients. Things are not looking really good. And we also have quite a rise in the number of deaths everyday deaths compared to what we had previously. So yeah, it's pretty bad down here.
And what's daily life like in Kenya right now in terms of the pandemic? Are things shut down or are people out and about and in restaurants and that sort of thing?
We are actually on a partial lockdown as I speak. In Kenya, we have things called counties, which I think in your country could be things like towns or something like that. So different towns that have high numbers of patients, COVID patients, have been locked down. So no movements within those towns or outside those towns. Restaurants have been locked out. Bars are not functioning. Public vehicles have been halted, their movement. So our lives have been affected quite a lot because the guys, people who are dependent on this kind of things, on the vehicles to travel and do their businesses and different kind of livelihoods come from different kinds of activities. So most of these activities have been halted here due to COVID. So it's really affected people and a lot people because people have lost their jobs. People have had to be sent out of their homes because they cannot pay rent. So yeah, it's affected as much.
Yeah.
Economically, socially, financially, in all ways. We're not going to church, even spiritually, because yeah, the churches are closed as well.
Yeah, sounds very difficult. So let's talk about vaccinations. What's been the access in Kenya so far to getting a vaccination?
Kenya received the first shipment of vaccines, which were 1 million doses. And so far, this was meant to be for healthcare professionals first. They were supposed to get the first priorities. Then we go to the elderly and those with pre-existing conditions. Then if any other vaccines, we have any extras, they'd be given to others. But we are a population of up to 50 million. So the 1 million doses we got are like a tenth of what we are supposed to be getting. So pretty much there's a rush. We have the vaccine, but people are fighting for it. Even the healthcare professionals, not everyone has gotten vaccinated yet. And already there's a rush. We are running out of it. Most hospitals are already complaining of running out of stock of the vaccine.
And what about the cost? These vaccines were supposed to be free of cost. What's happening in Kenya around that?
The vaccines were supposed to be free and actually are supposed to be free. But due to large numbers of patients and demands of this vaccine, some hospitals are already taking advantage of this situation. So it depends on how much money you can give so that you get the vaccine because you want your parents vaccinated, you want your grandparents vaccinated. So there's quite a number. And Nairobi being a major, the capital city of Kenya, most people prefer bringing their old folks to Nairobi to get the vaccine. So this is increasing the number of demands of vaccine in hospitals. So most hospitals with high demands, they prefer to charge so that to control the traffic that's coming in for vaccination. Because when it's free, everyone else is going to get there. When they put a price tag to it, it's going to push away some people. So especially the private hospitals, some of the public hospitals, they are already charging the vaccine, which is supposed to be free for everyone.
So it sounds like then there must be an enormous inequity in terms of who is able to get vaccinated if the system is being kind of weeded out because of those who have money.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And what are you seeing in terms of hesitancy about getting vaccinated there?
At first, when the vaccine arrived, because of what we used to hear, the side effects and the complications and everything that could arise because of the vaccine, guys were scared. People were scared and very few people went there voluntarily to get the vaccine. But after we saw quite a number of people who went for the vaccine and they're just fine. Now people have accepted the vaccine and everything else is just flowing. Mm-hmm. Now there's a rise of demands and people wanting to actually get vaccinated from all around the country.
What does your hospital need and the people of Kenya need right now when it comes to getting COVID-19 under control?
Proper education about COVID to everyone else. Not everybody really is aware of this COVID. And up to date, we still have people who are doubting if there is COVID or not. First of all, the government and the Ministry of Health should put into place a team that goes out there to educate people on COVID. Number two, we have charges that were imposed on the COVID tests, and they charged exorbitantly for that. Very high prices, up to 10,000 shillings to charge for a COVID test. Number three, we now have the vaccine around, but because they are not well informed about what to expect with the vaccine, they tend to shy away from it because of the simple complications or simple things that come after the vaccination.
So in terms of the government action that you talked about, like the need for education or the need for regulating these private markets, is it, you know, what are the obstacles for the Kenyan government from doing that? I mean, is this a resource issue or is this a politics issue? I mean, we had enormous problems in the United States with the Trump administration giving mixed signals about the epidemic early on. But I'm trying to understand, you know, how much of this is economics versus political belief system?
Well, I think most of it here is this political belief system. Because from what I hear, I'm not really into the government and the system, but from what I hear here, we are getting donations that are COVID related. We got donations when COVID first came. We are still getting donations from different countries. And even the PPEs that we lack, we got a donation from, was it Jack Ma or somebody, but a whole shipment of PPEs, which we never received. So, and at some point, they turned out to selling it. The people who received it brought it to the market and started selling the PPEs to us, things that were supposed to be given to us for free. So I think it's more of the administration and the political system, other than anything financial or, economical.
And is that causing any kind of, reaction from the citizens of the country? Is this destabilizing the political situation there?
The political situation looks pretty stable because even before we had this second lockdown, we had our first lockdown when this thing first hit hard. So when we had our first lockdown, things were under control. People were told, you wear your mask, make sure you're protected, maintain the social distancing, avoid shaking hands and everything else that we needed to do. And the guys, most people followed those rules. So when there was a documentary that was done with one of our news presenters that showed actually how our COVID, the money that is, the donations that we receive regards COVID are being squandered by the politicians. So people got tired and people said no, there's no COVID. Yeah, it's at that point that people started not believing that there's really COVID in the country. So guys just became careless. Those who used to wear masks stopped wearing masks. People just started mingling and things just became chaotic. And I think that's why we have the surge we have right now. Because even our politicians, they went out there and started holding their political rallies. And you know, our political rallies hold quite a number, like up to 10,000 people, and there's no social distancing, there's no putting on masks. So people started mingling. And when the third wave came along, so we have a lot of numbers. And actually, currently, we are blaming the government for getting us to where we are right now. It's just that they don't listen to us, or our representation is not as strong as it should be. But yeah, we blame them much for where we are right now. They really messed us. Because of their political needs, they started calling on the rallies, getting people into large numbers, dishing out money, you know. So they messed everything up again.
Well, I hope things improve there soon. It sounds very, very difficult. Dr. Beryl Akun is a doctor in Nairobi, Kenya, and the African Medical Research Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, too, for having me here.
Every memory you think you have of the past.
The house you grew up in, your first kiss.
It's not simply an idea, it's a physical trace left in your brain.
I own those memories. They define me.
But what happens when those memories are stolen from you?
In the blink of an eyelid.
Can you imagine what to have one night 20 years long? That's what it's been like. Just like this.
Memory and Forgetting on Radiolab. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Nancy Solomon, in for Tanzina. Last week, President Joe Biden announced 11 nominees to the federal courts as part of his effort to reshape the judicial branch after 4 years of Donald Trump. His first slate of nominees is notably diverse in terms of race, gender, and legal background. They include 3 Black women for vacancies on the appeals court and the first Muslim American on the district court. But to put his mark on the judicial system, President Biden has a long way to go to come anywhere near the 200-plus judges that were confirmed under former President Trump. For more on this, we're joined by Jen Bendery, senior politics reporter for HuffPost. Jen, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about some of these people that Joe Biden is nominating.
So Joe Biden has announced 11 judicial nominees. It's very exciting for people who follow this because there's been a lot of anticipation on who he's going to put forward. Of those, 10 of them would be federal judges once confirmed, and one of them is a nominee for a superior court in D.C. In terms of diversity, it's a pretty incredible mix. We've got a lot of historic numbers in here. As you mentioned, there are 3 African-American women who have been nominated to appeals court seats. And for a little context on why that's a big deal, to date, only 8 African-American women have ever served as appeals court judges in the history of this country. Wow. And with Biden announcing 3 African-American women as appeals court nominees, that is already shaking the foundation of what our courts could look like. 3 African-American women, if they are confirmed to appeals courts, that would be the same number of African-American women judges who have ever been confirmed in a single presidential administration. He's off to a very impressive start with in terms of diversity.
One of those judges is Ketanji Brown Jackson, who will succeed Merrick Garland on the appeals court. How significant is her appointment?
So there's a lot of buzz about Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. Not only would she be one of those 3 African-American women to be confirmed to an appeals court seat, but there's a lot of attention on her being potentially Biden's next Supreme Court nominee. And part of the reason for that is that President Biden has already said that he will nominate an African-American woman as his first Supreme Court nominee. He has made that vow. But secondly, Ketanji Brown Jackson, who's currently a district court judge, she is nominated to a seat on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. And that court in particular is kind of known as a holding pattern for potential Supreme Court nominees. There's a number of our current Supreme Court justices who were on that court first. So there's a whole bunch of buzz around her nomination in Washington right now because she kind of fits, she looks like she's on that track to potentially be our next Supreme Court nominee.
And tell us a little bit about her and how she got there.
Well, she's been on the D.C. District Court since 2013, and before that, she was a vice chair of the U.S. Sentencing Commission. So she's got a pretty mixed up, interesting background. She was a law clerk for a judge before that on a district court in Massachusetts, and she was also a law clerk for a judge on a U.S. appeals court in the 90s. She was also an associate for a law firm. I mean, she's got a very rich background. She also clerked for Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer back in 1999 to 2000. So she's been all over the board. And she's, again, she would be a historic nominee, not just because she would be an African-American woman on an appeals court, but if she were put forward for the Supreme Court, obviously we've never had an African-American woman on that court.
You know, this drive to diversify the federal bench, I mean, you know, we're seeing an effort across the board, or at least a conversation in all walks of life in the country about diversity. But it seems to me that judges, because of their role in the criminal justice system and because the criminal justice system is really one of the harshest and, you know, most troubling places where the legacy of racism in this country has such a huge impact. Do you think that we're going to see like real change in the criminal justice system by bringing in more Black judges onto the bench?
So what's really fascinating about where I think Biden is going with his judicial nominees is not just that he's interested in diversifying things like the race and the gender of the nominees he's going to put forward, but this idea of professional diversity, this idea that we don't just look at demographics for diversity in judges, we want to know what their backgrounds were. We don't just want corporate lawyers and prosecutors to become federal judges. What about public defenders? Well, they're totally qualified to become federal judges. What about civil rights attorneys? What about people who don't work at huge law firms just being the default for becoming a federal judge? And that's what's going to be really interesting, I think, with Biden's picks, because he's making that case already that, you know, this idea that the courts are supposed to reflect the people that they serve. And so if you have judges who have been public defenders or civil rights attorneys, these are people who are more familiar with the legal needs of everyday Americans who may be living on lower incomes or otherwise marginalized. So when you have a slate of Harvard-educated white male judges who all worked at corporations or were prosecutors deciding cases that are involving people who have absolutely no connection to their frame of reference from their own experiences, that's a problem. And I think Biden, who himself, he was a public defender back in the day, so he understands personally the importance of mixing up the backgrounds of the people we're putting on the courts, because it just brings this thing full circle in terms of having our courts reflect the people they serve.
It's kind of surprising that this hasn't happened before. Is that what you're saying, that the example you gave of public defenders, has there not been a push to put public defenders, raise them up onto the bench?
So progressive groups have been calling for this for years. And there's certainly people who have said, we need to diversify the federal bench, you know, in terms of professions. But if you look at, let's go back a little bit chronologically. If you look at Trump's judicial nominees, they were almost entirely white male, former corporate lawyers and prosecutors, and kind of like the standard mold of what this country has used to pick people to be federal judges. So that was 4 years of Trump. Now, under Obama, he was much more focused on diversity of his judicial nominees, but he was more focused on things like demographics, race, gender, sexuality, those kinds of things. And he put forward a number of historic judicial nominees on those fronts. But when we come back to this idea of professional diversity, even Obama did not make a big push on that. And it appears the moment has arrived. We have a former public defender in the White House. We have progressive groups loudly pushing this idea that we need professional diversity here. And you've got senators like Elizabeth Warren who have been talking about this for years, when most other senators do not make this a priority when they talk about the kinds of judges that they want to fill the seats in their states.
And do we have any sense at this point of what kind of obstacles these nominees are going to face as they get to the 50-50 Senate?
Of course. I mean, if passed as precedent, Republicans, at least some Republicans, are going to try to oppose most of Biden's judicial nominees for the sole reason that they are Joe Biden's nominees. That is what happened under President Obama for years. There was unprecedented obstruction of his judicial nominees for the sole purpose that they were just Obama's nominees. So the stories you might hear of how partisan and gridlocked, you know, DC can get and Congress and the White House and these things, when it comes to judicial nominees, that is right in the center of it all. Republicans typically don't want to support, they will not often want to support, particularly an appeals court nominee from a president of a different party right now. That said, district court nominees often are recommended directly by a senator to the White House. So you're going to see more support for district nominees that Biden puts forward. But for the appeals court nominees, I suspect Republicans are probably going to make a stink about many of them. They'll probably call them too progressive, too liberal. But, you know, we've got to watch this play out, though. You can't just unilaterally say no to all judges, because people need judges in their states. Even if you are in a deep red state, you still need judges to fill your courts, because these courts are overworked.
And of course, there were the three openings on the Supreme Court that Trump was able to fill. What's the likelihood of President Biden being able to fill a SCOTUS seat during his term?
So I get this question a lot, and it makes me laugh, because I feel like there's a lot of speculation about, you know, who will Biden put on the Supreme Court? When are we going to see his nominee? How is he going to mix it up? Who is his African-American woman choice going to be? But the reality is somebody has to die on the court, or somebody has to retire right now. And for the moment, nobody has died and nobody is saying they're going to retire. And that's about as basic as it gets. You know, I saw that White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki was recently asked this very question, and her response was, there are no vacancies on the Supreme Court to fill, so we don't have a nominee right now. So that's, I mean, that's really where the rubber hits the road with Supreme Court speculation. However, of course, there are conversations that may be happening behind the scenes. You know, is President Biden talking to Justice Breyer about retiring? I don't know. But my sense is that for the moment, this is, while all eyes are always on the Supreme Court, right now, President Biden is very focused on moving quickly on putting up nominees to fill all these other vacancies on the appeals court level and on the district court level.
Jen Bendery is a senior politics reporter for HuffPost. Jen, thanks for joining us.
Anytime.
Please pack your knives and go. Please pack your knives and go.
Please pack your knives
and go.
Please pack your knives and go.
Last week, the 18th season of the cooking competition show Top Chef premiered on Bravo. The series brings together talented chefs from across the country to showcase their culinary skills and the food that defines them. And the contestants who don't make it to the next round are dismissed with this refrain.
Please pack your knives and go.
The latest season of Top Chef was shot in Portland, Oregon during the pandemic. But that isn't the only thing different about season 18. This one has a higher number of black chefs judging the contestants. This past fall, in a piece for the Washington Post, food writer Jonna French found that black chefs were underrepresented both as contestants and judges over the course of the show's history. And that lack of representation extends far beyond Top Chef into many other popular cooking shows and the fine dining world as a whole.
Please pack your knives and go.
Please pack your knives and go.
Please pack your knives and go.
With me now to talk about his experience on the show is Eric Ajapong, Top Chef finalist and cookbook author. Eric, great to have you here.
Nancy, thank you so much. How are you?
I'm good. Beautiful spring day here in New Jersey, coming to you from home. Before we get into your time on Top Chef, tell us about the food that you've cooked and highlighted over the course of your career.
It's been mostly food of really the African diaspora. I first generation Ghanaian American. My folks came to the States in the late 80s. So a lot of the inspiration and the flavors and techniques and I guess combinations of all of that that I draw my inspiration from comes from that very source. A lot of things that I grew up eating, a lot of things that I grew up around as well. I was lucky enough to grow up in a very diverse neighborhood as far as Caribbean communities and Hispanic communities and Jewish communities and Italian communities not too far nearby in the Bronx, New York. So it, you know, just so happened that I fell into you know, my industry and this craft that I can pick up all those inspirations and techniques of, you know, my childhood.
Sounds delicious. had you seen chefs cook Ghanaian or other types of West African food on television before you went on Top Chef?
Unfortunately, not quite. You know, you see it sporadically, maybe in like local television or, you know, highlighted in a piece, on a travel channel or something like that, but nothing that really kind of focused, for a long arcing kind of series or a season at least, that focused on West African food or Ghanaian food specifically. So when I had the opportunity to come on, Top Chef, you know, I knew I could have went any route as far as, you know, making modern American or, you know, modern French food or Italian food, in which I was trained in. But I figured that I had a really unique advantage or viewpoint if I were to come into the competition with a little bit of the background that I had from this West African influences and you know, the ingredients that I brought in as well. And it fared well for me.
Well, you've been on Top Chef twice as a contestant, and both times you were eliminated during the competitions when you based your meals around the history of the transatlantic slave trade. So first, let's pick that all apart. But first, tell us what that, you know, what you were trying to do by combining that story with food, and how were you trying to do that?
The first season, or my first season, rather, on season 16, I had made it all the way up into the finale and had the opportunity to cook any four dishes that I wanted to for, I guess, my offering. And I wanted to really tell the story of the transatlantic slave trade. It's an unfortunate story, but I've never heard it or experienced in that story being told through food. And there's a whole long arc of the ingredients that were brought by and brought to the New World, and the cooking techniques, and some of the food and the meals that we grow and love today here in the American South, jambalaya and gumbo are all akin to traditional West African dishes. So I really wanted to highlight that as much as possible in four courses. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to do that. I was eliminated right before I could. And then when season 17 came, ironically, I was eliminated presenting that premise in a restaurant. And that was more so just technical issues, I'll be honest with you. I knew exactly why I fell off. It was a bad cook. And I completely took onus. I guess it was more ironic that it happened on both of those times. But the first time around on season 16, when I was in it, it was weird because I'm so much in the fog. But when I got back home and it reached social media and there was such an uproar, there was a huge kind of fanfare and push for me to actually be able to tell that story. And Tom Colicchio, the head judge of Top Chef, allowed me to do so at his restaurant and Kraft in New York.
Oh, nice.
And I was also able to do that in a few other places as well. I cooked for the president of Bermuda with the same four courses as well, which is really fun. So in different ways, I was able to kind of cook the same meal and really enjoy those spoils as well.
The Washington Post article made the argument that the lack of Black judges is an economic issue, that ultimately this disadvantages Black and brown chefs who are trying to make it in the restaurant business. Do you agree with that?
No. I really think there's a good group of talent that look like me and that have a voice to say. I think there's a hold on, a lot of what the word is about food and the gatekeepers of food, so to speak. And I'm looking forward to new voices and new blood, so to speak, coming in and really putting their thoughts and their minds behind the food that we eat.
You're based in Washington, D.C., and this is our show's first week broadcasting on WAMU in the city. What should people know about D.C.'s West African culinary scene?
It's growing. It's budding. There's so many great restaurants coming up and hopefully making their way out of the pandemic. Bukum and Apio are two that come to mind out in D.C. D.C. is so known for East African food and Central African food, but West African food and chefs are definitely making their way up. Kith & Kin was a restaurant that I was a part of that closed down before the pandemic, but a really strong push into that direction as well. So come to DC, eat some great African food in general. Honestly, it's all over the continent with great restaurants all over the city.
So you've also been on Chopped and Beat Bobby Flay. Was the judging environment similar on those shows?
Ultimately, I didn't see anyone that looked directly like me, being, a judge or deliberating on the dish, and again, for me, it's not necessarily something that's extremely far-fetched. Coming in culinary school, there wasn't a lot of people that looked like me. Working up in the industry, there weren't a lot of people that looked like me. So in an unfortunate way, it's just, it is what it is in second nature. But I really, really hope and wish to see more chefs of the African diaspora coming in and deliberating. There's a whole other world and psyche around food and understanding of palate and textures and ingredients and things like that, that I think, the expertise of a judge who understands that can really kind of take a show to the next level.
This lack of representation in a TV cooking show, it also occurs in culinary schools and high-end kitchens, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. For sure. It's just an unfortunate kind of reality of the fact. There aren't just a lot of African-American or just people of the diaspora, period, in the culinary space. You know, I think about as great as my undergrad was in Johnson & Wales University, there really wasn't much of an understanding of like African food. And I, you know, all 4 years I studied Italian and French and modern American and, you know, the different types of Asian cuisines as well, but nothing really that came from the continent. And if it was very sporadic and nothing too detailed. So, you know, it was one thing that kind of bothered me kind of leaving school. And I say this all the time, but Africa being the second biggest continent in the world and the food being so underrepresented doesn't make too much sense to me, especially in my field. So, you know, being that I come from or have direct lineage to the continent, to the country specifically, and then also have these understandings of modern technique and how to compose a dish and make it look good and also make it taste good, I kind of feel like it's my duty to kind of put those two worlds together.
So, speaking to the people who are really biased in favor of, say, Italian and French food and just believe in their hearts that it's the best food to eat, what dish would you put in front of them and what would you say, you know, tell us about a dish and why it's so good and worthy of their attention, respect, and eating?
That's a really, I love Italian food. I love French.
Well, yeah,
food
of course.
Well. Yeah, everybody, it's hard to beat. I mean, it's masters at their craft, honestly. But I think when you put a dish like jollof rice or wache or, you know, maybe some fried fish or a tilapia and some shitsong kenke and or some fufu, and you really kind of compare the two, you're eating, I mean, and I guess the easiest sense, it's apples and oranges. Honestly, they're two different kind of cuisines, so to speak. But you are eating food, you are getting culture, you are getting experience, and you are getting stories as well, the same way you would get in Italy or in France or in Asia. So being open to, you know, the cuisine and, you know, the use of spices and ingredients that you might be familiar, you know, with turmeric or allspice or ground ginger and garlic, but maybe in combinations that you may not be used to and be really unique and tasty to you as well. So just be open, I think, with any cuisine that you've tried in the past and you've never kind of had it before. You had an open mind and you went in really curious. And, that's really the push that we're looking for with African cuisine. So,
well, let's talk about fufu, because when I had an opportunity to go to Africa, it was a revelation to me. I had never heard of it, and I loved it. And I think you could make the argument that it is it kind of hits the sweet spot between pasta and polenta. So, how would you describe it? Like, because to me, fufu really takes on Italian food like straight on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when it comes to Italian, the running joke with a lot of like African bobs, West African bobs, is making sure that you're like beyond fed before you leave the house, right? So fufu is one of those dishes that keeps you satiated and holds you down for a long time, much like you know, a pasta dish or a really like big a meal in Italy. You know, you can have lunch and pretty much be good for later on in the day. So fufu is just honestly, it's steamed, pounded and steamed plantain, green plantain and cassava, either one of the both or a combination of the two. As it's steamed, it's pounded and it becomes super, super supple, enough to a point where you can almost like it's a swallow. So you can pick it up and it has that polenta kind of consistency or qualities to it, like you mentioned. And it's delicious. It's like a plank canvas. So it's a really versatile kind of vessel. You can add any sort of soups or stews or chutneys or whatever the case that you want to it. And it's just like the perfect way to kind of pick up, you know, your protein or honestly, whatever vegetable or grain that you have. And then you can pick up your sauce, or your soup with it. You know, either with the spoon or traditionally with a clean hand, and you're good to go. It's honestly delicious.
Sounds terrific. Eric Ajapong is a Top Chef finalist and cookbook author. Eric, thanks so much.
Absolutely, Nancy. Thank you so much.
That's all we have for you today. Really appreciate being here with you. Hope you enjoyed the show. We enjoy hearing your voices and putting them on the air. So please continue to call us with your comments or suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. You can also record a voice memo and email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com or send us a tweet at @thetakeaway. You can also tweet me at Nancy Solomon, too. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Nancy Solomon, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.